The second letter that they received, care of the resurrecting king, the gentle emperor, was somewhat less prolix than the first. They were lurking in the personal Nonagesimus library, a stone-arched room packed tight with shelves of the musty and neglected books Harrowhark didn't study, and the musty, less neglected books that she did. Gideon sat on a broad, sagging desk piled high with pages covered in necromantic marginalia, most of them in Harrow's cramped, impatient writing. She held the letter before her with one hand. With the other, she wearily painted her face with a piece of fiber wadding and a pot of alabaster paint, feeling absurdly young. The paint smelled acid and cold, and working the damn stuff into the creases next to her nose meant sucking globs of paint up her nostrils all day. Harrow was sprawled on a sofa spread with tattered brocade, robes abandoned, scrawny black-clad legs crossed at the ankles. In Gideon's mind, she looked like an evil stick. You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, Episode 5. Act accordingly. What I learned from this passage immediately is that Tamsin Muir has worn grease paint.
It's a thing that will cue the people who know what it's referring to immediately. You're like, ugh.
Yeah, because before I had done Gideon cosplay for the first time, I read this passage and I went, yeah, okay. And after I had done Gideon cosplay for the first time, I was like, yeah, ugh.
I use a water-based paint for my cosplays, so I did not have that sensory knowledge. I'm glad one of us did. Because, like, the experience of applying different paint textures. Again, with the beautiful sensory language. Gobs is such a wonderful gobs as descriptions of like volumes of things. A glob is generally not a is only in some very specific contexts a positive volume, but is almost never a positive volume when it comes to being on your body.
And in your nostril. There's
And
no
in your
globs in
nostril.
your nostril. That's a good
If
thing.
that glob did not originate from your nostril, why is it there?
And even if it did, the sense of having a glob in your nostril, even if it is an emic glob, it's bad. It's just not a good
You're
feeling.
like, hey, I got some sticks at the ends of my hands. I gotta get that glob out of there. I in my day-to-day work deal with a lot of globs.
I bet.
I love the line about Harrow's writing.
The cramped, impatient writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is so I have ADHD and my handwriting is different depending on whether I'm medicated or not. And when I first noticed this, I found it really fascinating. Handwritten text as an expression of temperament and mood and focus. Like it's cramped and it's impatient, but it's not messy. That's not what's how it's been described. It's not, I imagine it to be very small.
I also imagine it to be very small.
Harrow is someone who writes an extremely small script. What I'm curious about is Harrow a like handwriting script writer, or does she write letter by letter? Because Gideon, letter by letter, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Harrow likes control and polish and refinement for performance, but not necessarily for her own internal process.
My marginalia is all in print because it's a little bit easier to get really tiny.
And Harrow is practical, so I could see her probably experiencing and coming to the same conclusion.
But, Darwin's marginalia is in script, so this is certainly not a universal judgment.
No, and script is known to be a faster way of writing,
It is.
and Harrow thinks fast and constantly. So being able to just jot something down, like it doesn't say it's shorthand, but I could see Harrow inventing her own shorthand.
Certainly. And I think many scholars do end up inventing their own shorthand because there are things that you refer to over and over again that you know what you mean. And in fact, within this chapter, I have marginalia that just says NP in all caps for necropolitics.
Of course, right. So we talked a little bit about your heart is a party of 5,000 nails. In the context of like the way Muir alludes to other parts of the books. This chapter is loaded with those kinds of references. The first one is, why would there be a necromantic gathering on a space station? And I was like, well, it's funny that you asked. We will get to that.
Absolutely. So we learn a lot about how necromancy works in that
Yes.
passage.
From Gideon's magazines, she had discovered the quote, never send an adept to do a soldier's job. When I was listening to this chapter, I heard that wrong, and I heard never send an addict to do a soldier's job,
Oof.
which, having immediately followed this description of Harrow and her ilk sucking up death energy with a straw, I was like, I could see how Gideon would have a view of necromancers in which their consumption of thanergy would be parallel to someone who has a substance dependency. People who are dependent on external power to do the things that they want to do often don't have more slow, organic means of getting their tasks accomplished. Once you have a relationship to a really intense source of power and energy, you develop an entire strategy around that. The easiest analogy is our dependence on petrochemical fuels. Like, adept makes way more sense than addict in this writing. But the relationship between necromancy and a dependency on thanergy is now in my brain in a way that will continue for a while, I imagine. While making an analogy to addiction is not something I want to do without unpacking addiction as a way that we label people's behaviors, I do think there is something to be said about dependency on extractive power that is really important.
This was actually the passage that I had marked necropolitics next to, because we see the first clues of an extractive mechanism of the cohort that is not material extraction in the way that we are sort of used to seeing in Empire, but where death is itself a key resource that's being produced by the Forever War. And the deaths of these unnamed, invisible, beneath interest, colonized others who Gideon does not even conceptualize in this narrative, except as puddles of death energy. Th they are literally the fuel of the necromancers.
Gideon's disdain for this is immediately apparent. And it's not a disdain that is like necromancy is bad. It's a disdain in the sense of Gideon admires the way soldiers do their jobs and does not really respect the way necromancers do their jobs. And part of that you can feel in this like puddle of death juice. Like, this is not a reverent term of thanergy. Gideon does not think well of thanergy. Gideon's like, this is kind of gross.
This attitude reminds me very strongly of the general attitude of enlisted military personnel to officers as people who don't have real jobs. My mother was a naval petty officer, and if you call a petty officer ma'am, the automatic response is, don't call me ma'am, I work for a living.
Ma'am is a desk job term? Is that the.
Ma'am and sir are how you address an officer. A petty officer, which is a non-commissioned officer, so the major division in military ranks is like enlisted and then officers. But within the top ranks of the enlisted are non-commissioned officers, which is like sergeants, petty officers, specialists who have more power but are still kind of considered like on the ground people. And those people, if you call them ma'am or sir, as you would with an officer, they will chew you out.
So this might be the kind of mentality that a Glemene might hold, being like, don't confuse me with them.
I'm not a lieutenant. I actually have to clean my boots for something other than aesthetics. The idea of the space station tells us a little bit about how necromancy works. There aren't the big puddles of death in deep space, and so we get the sense that necromancy is a thing that happens on planets and on planets with life.
Which means that Forever War is happening on the ground, not in space.
This is not ship-to-ship combat. This is not space lasers. This is ground, which makes sense because we have infantry with swords.
Yeah, we've infantry with swords, and we also have examples of guns, which is an interesting contrast.
Yeah, we don't get guns until later, but
We don't get guns until later, and the people who have guns are not the infantry.
We see in this chapter Harrow being dramatically more relaxed than we have ever seen her previously, both in terms of her physical body language. She is just like splayed out on a couch, and she's also being a lot more open with Gideon. She still draws a hard line. She's like, I'm not letting you in on anything important. You will not know anything. You are not part of this. You're not making judgments here. But she is, for the first time, being really open about how she is imagining the strategy, and we're seeing a lot more of what's going on for her.
And we're also seeing a thing that we saw before, which is that when it is just Harrow and Gideon, Harrow behaves quite differently. Harrow's performances are less for Gideon. I think Harrow is like, Gideon isn't the audience for Harrow's performance. The rest of the ninth is. Gideon knows what and who Harrow is in a way that I don't think Harrow bothers performing for her anymore. She'll just be like, no, I'm not telling you. This is what I expect. It's non-negotiable. And no, I'm not telling you why. But I will tell you that, like, unadornedly, this is my expectation, and this is like what you need to understand about that. Without and there's also very little degradation happening in this conversation in a way that was very obvious in other previous conversations when there were other members of the ninth in the room.
There is a very clear, very strong power differential in this scene, but there's much less hostility coming from Harrow. There's still plenty coming from Gideon, but but yeah, Harrow isn't insulting Gideon. Harrow isn't, we're not seeing the sort of gratuitous cruelty. She is just kind of like, here's the plan, here's what's going to happen. And I think the moment where she shows Gideon the letter and says, tell me the implications, there's a testing element, like a pedagogical element. She wants to make sure that Gideon is thinking things through and is capable of thinking things through.
And she doesn't really put a lot of effort into correcting Gideon's response. Like, this is an example where, she makes the crack that Gideon is illiterate, and Gideon's like, you know what, fuck you, no. But she thinks that Gideon is capable of the basic analysis that she's expecting. She's like, yep, this is what this looks like. It is just us going to be on there. And that is loaded and comes with a lot of requirements. It is kind of funny imagining Crux on the ninth, sorry, on the first.
Yeah, I mean, Gideon's not wrong. They would be fucked if they had to take Crux and Aglamine. Like, how would the house function?
And it would out them as under-resourced and dying far quicker than Gideon saying something stupid.
Absolutely.
If it's like, this is who you brought to like the greatest summons in 10,000 years, you brought these cranky, like,
That's your whole deal, huh?
but Gideon believes that the others will be crumbly old hierophants. Like, is that what their belief about the other houses are bringing, or who is on the first?
I think that, I mean, that's Gideon's point of reference for a place that is religious in nature. And I think Gideon is imagining the first as being sort of the house, but like more and closer to God.
That tracks. That definitely tracks. I love the phrase pizza face. It both means nothing and everything all at once.
Is this not like a stock phrase in Canada?
I've never this is another one of those ones where I listen to it first and then I read it and I'm like, I heard a Pete, like the name Pete's face, where I'm like, that's a weird reference, seems very specific. I'm sure it makes sense to someone. No,
This is
pizza
a,
actually makes more sense to me.
yeah, pizza face is a teenage insult for somebody with a lot of acne. She is complaining that the paint
The
makes her
paint will
break
make
out.
her break out. Gotcha. Yeah. Pizza face and a toothpick. This made me look at the cover art a little bit more, and I want to highlight something interesting about the sword they chose to use in the cover art. Its grip is unusually long for a rapier. It is almost a hand and a half worth of grip,
It is.
which I want to ask why that was chosen, because that's fascinating to me. I specialize
That's
in
also
a
quite a thick
sword.
rapier, which makes sense visually, but.
It excites me because the sword that I specialize in is actually closer to what is used on the cover than a rapier. A long sword has two hands worth of grip. When you have a hand and a half worth of grip, you can do some of the things that a long sword can do. So it's interesting to me that that was the choice that was made. Basically, when you have two hands worth of leverage, you're going to start wrestling with your sword. A rapier with one hand is more pokey, like a toothpick. But the sword they chose is not that. So it's that's curious to me. Another phrase that I thought was really interesting in looking at defining personality, two out of three is not three. The phrase is often two out of three ain't bad.
Yeah.
No, Gideon
No,
is a
that
two
is
out of three is not three.
Harrow, yeah.
She's like, what is the bare minimum that we can expect here to get this done? And she's like, you're just gonna have to not talk. Like, we can't get that one out of three unless you shut up. And then we're not even really getting it, but at least we're not gonna get like two out of three plus minus one.
Yeah, two out of three is still not three is a really powerful statement about Harrow's personality and how she understands the notion of requirements.
And how she puts pressure on herself. This is the language that she uses towards herself as well. This is the language and the logic that said, I'm going to make my parents into puppets.
Speaking of which, they talk about her parents and they absolutely don't talk about her parents. There is such a strong veil of euphemism around what's happening. They both know, and they both know that they both know. And the thing that Harrow says is, my parents are no longer able to take care of the house's interests, which is such a like, yeah, babe, they sure aren't.
There's pain there. There's fear, there's grief there. It is being hidden behind an incredibly thick euphemism. When my grandmother was dying, my father's mother, I asked why we didn't as a family talk about it. And my father said this line that has like continued to resonate with me as one of the most intense, not euphemism, but like, this is where the line is, and we're not going to go on. We're not going to talk beyond it, which is that my grandmother did not live her life in a way that endeared herself to her children. The level of pain and disappointment in that phrasing to me also is very resonant of Gideon being like, my parents can no longer meet the needs and attend to the needs of the ninth. Like, it's that, like, this pain and disappointment is so profound. We will talk about it as if it is somebody else's problem. We will talk about it as if it is an administrative issue. We will like.
Yeah, it's so practical and it's so remote. And in context, of course, she is talking about the vulnerabilities of the ninth house, but it's the only acknowledgement she makes of not having parents as a teenager.
Yeah. How many times do you think Hera has threatened to kill Gideon?
A bunch.
Because she's real chill about it. But like the thing is, I can't imagine Hera not meaning it.
That's the thing. You don't take this, it doesn't look like dismissal, but it also doesn't look unserious.
Hera's not a jokey kind of gal.
And this, again, for me, points to I see this and I hear like, yeah, she does mean it and she has followed through on it in the past.
She has followed through on in the past, and to Harrow, killing someone is not quite the same thing at like she's like, yeah, you can still have utility to me. Like it's a weird kind of threat in the context where she's like, I'll just reanimate you into a puppet too. Like is a subtext in that threat.
Whereas the threat that she makes at the end of the chapter when she says, if I'd had my way, I would have sent you off in nine different boxes with all the different houses and one for Crux to keep in his old age, that feels empty. That feels like a silly boast. But this is, I will kill you.
Like, it'll
Full
just be
stop,
easier.
casual, like I will just kill you.
And Gideon is like, naturally. Like, yeah, okay. Like, this threat has come and gone enough times that Gideon's like, okay, well, I understand what you'd do if you did kill me. That's stupid. Like,
I wonder if Harrow has killed anyone else in the ninth house for management reasons.
I can't help but keep thinking about, like, just because Harrow killed someone, death does not mean that you are no longer part of the community. Death does not mean that you are free of your responsibilities. Like, it is a management decision to turn someone into a farm skeleton. They have received a second piece of paper.
They have received a second piece of paper, and Gideon is once again folding it up into tiny pieces.
I think of my work as an educator and the amount of pleasure that small children get from tearing paper into little pieces and crumpling it up, but that is also a really valuable fine motor and sensory development technique. I've been talking a lot in my little corner of the internet about various things to do with early childhood development, and recently talking about, like, age-appropriate behaviors. Children ripping books apart is a developmentally appropriate behavior. The joy and the sensory joy that children experience in doing so, I think, is the same kind of sensory joy that Gideon is tapping into here, as this being a rare experience that her body has not ex like integrated and added to the mix. But it is, even as an adult, when you find a new sensory experience that is, like, novel and pleasurable, you're like, stim, stim, do the thing, do the thing. This does seem, though, like these letters are not the only paper Gideon has touched. So it's fun to think of, like,
No,
what other paper?
I completely agree that the pleasure of touching this strongly signals that there have been other instances of this kind of tactile. Like, she knows she wants to touch this paper. She knows it's going to be good.
I'm imagining Gideon breaking into little Gideon breaking into little Harrow's library and just, like, ruining a book. And ruining could be just grubby fingers, but, like, I think one of the most, like, maybe specifically designed personal attacks that Gideon might ever do on Harrow is to go and make a book irreparably damaged.
Yeah.
Both the cost of that, but the, like, personal attack that is damaging one of Harrow's necromancy tomes.
New headcanon. Gideon sometimes just steals a page out of stuff.
Crip. And then sits, and whenever they're mad at Harrow after stealing that page, maybe Harrow hasn't discovered it missing yet, they'll just, like, slowly rip off little pieces. Just, like, they don't have to do it in front of Harrow. But maybe Harrow knows that this is happening somewhere. And that's enough that Gideon's, like, really quite satisfied. But it's at the point now where that's not on Gideon's mind.
Yeah, and I think the seeing Gideon indulge in this little sensory pleasure also shows that Gideon, despite still being grumpy as hell in this chapter, is a lot more relaxed as well. Because when you're on edge and you're prepping for a fight and you're pissed, you're not sitting there stimming and being like, this is such a nice texture.
Yeah, and they're also relaxed because they've been in this room together before. Gideon is sitting on the desk.
Yeah.
Gideon's been in this room with Harrow before.
And Harrow's laid out on a couch. Harrow is not performing, as you said.
So, again, another fun thing to think about. What are the previous experiences that they've shared in this room? Like, I imagine their little grapple fight where Harrow's fingernails get fairly dirty with genetic material. I could see it happening
Euphemism that somehow
here.
makes that much, much grosser.
I could imagine that happening in this room.
Totally. And we
Maybe
know.
Hera walks in on Gideon ripping a page out and suddenly launches. I could see that driving Hera to that reaction.
Gideon was initially raised to be a nun until she was 10. So she probably received at least an early religious education that could have also involved scholarship. And until she was 10, at which point, she gets reconfigured professionally.
Yeah, and
Reconfigured.
perhaps
She.
that is when she begins training with Eglemine. They're like,
Yeah.
okay, you're
So
not for this path.
I'm imagining baby, baby Gideon and Harrow in early literacy together, being trained together, being taught to read together, and being just like regular little gobliny classmates.
And their age difference is
One
2 years.
year.
1 year?
One year.
So their age difference is 1 year. So there's a little bit of distinction in there, and I imagine Gideon would probably have held on to that I'm older than you in every moment possible.
There was a moment where Gideon was literally literate and Hera wasn't.
And it is entirely possible that those moments of education happened in this room. And this is also another one where, like, Harrow's high control personality often makes me think of people who are very fastidious about cleanliness, but that isn't our girl.
Yeah, our girl is gross.
Our girl is gross. Our girl is gross. And so this place is, she doesn't, this is her place of study, but like, I imagine it's kind of a gross place. Like, it's,
I imagine that whatever cleaning happens here is done by other people. I imagine that the scholarly materials are chaos. I am not imagining neat, fastidious stacks. I am imagining just papers and books and maps and what, like, just strewn everywhere kind of thing. If she puts anything away, it is for secrecy and not for neatness. I like, in contrast, I imagine Palamedes being much more kind of orderly.
Palamedes has not just his own shorthand, but he has his own indexing system.
Yeah.
Palamedes, out of all the characters, is the one that I would be like, I want to be friends with this guy. Like, we'd be good friends. I want to play Magic the Gathering with Palamedes.
I want to hang out with Abigail.
Yeah, gosh, every like, and Abigail's like, I want to hang out with you. Yeah, she's great. Three separate communiques from other houses.
Yeah.
Who? Which ones? Who's sending letters to the ninth? Palamedes, for sure.
I could see an argument for the third, the fifth, and the sixth.
The sixth is Silas and Colum, right?
Sixth is Palamedes.
Sixth is Palamedes, so third, fifth, Abigail Magnus? Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
We know that they're networky. And they send people invitations later. So that seems like it fits. Like they're less competitive and more oriented to like just meeting other people.
And I could see Ianthe like being like, I need to know who's going to be there and what I'm going to be dealing with.
And on a
And
protocol level as well,
yeah, totally.
because they're like high court fancy.
Yeah. But it's clear that there isn't a personal relationship about it.
No, which is quite weird and quite a big de departure from, models of European hereditary nobility where relationships of diplomacy and connection are expected and really critical. So we're not seeing inter-house diplomacy, despite the fact that,
Though
although.
they might be addressing those letters to Harrow's parents.
Certainly they are. I'm sure
And
they
so
are.
Harrow is not actually building relationships. She may be proxy facilitating something. She may be maintaining some, like we send, the annual newsletter of here's what we're doing on the night. No, not the night. They don't do an annual newsletter, but like Hera's
Well,
parents are receiving communiques from the larger empire to some degree, but it's not Hera's relationship building.
she's not responding to the letters, and she says that none of them even know her name, which means they have not been sharing information for years.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting, close to that same passage, the house has been closed to pilgrims for 5 years. And five is an interesting number here because Harrow's parents did not die 5 years ago. Harrow's parents
Yeah.
died 7 years ago. And then 2 years after that, the house closed to pilgrims.
Maybe it is that. So there's two thoughts that come to mind. One is that 2 years of Harrow trying to keep things the way things were so that no one notices that things changed. And then discovering that the house being open to pilgrims is an unsustainable load for this conspiracy that she's upholding. So there's, maybe a near miss somewhere and she's like, okay, we're done.
That's what I was thinking too. Like, what happened?
What happened? It's an administrative choice. And I completely forgot what the second thought that I had about that was. So we'll all just have to wonder what that was for the rest of our lives. Question: did Harrow turn her parents into puppets very quickly after they topped themselves, as is said in this chapter? Or maybe it took some time. Is that a skill she already had? Had she developed that spell and that necromancy by then? Does that 2 year period have to do with her developing her abilities around being a necromantic puppeteer?
How would she explain their absence for two? I mean, she explains their absence here, so I don't know.
There's the impression that her parents were never really warm people.
For sure.
So I could see them like not really being actively engaged with the pilgrims, which might make things easier on Harrow. That might be a thing where they're like, we've got nuns for that.
I think certainly it would make sense for pilgrims to have limited direct contact with, the lord and lady of the house. But they would have routine contact with house functionaries and other people in the community. They apparently have siblings, or if these are the great aunts or literal great aunts, then aunts. So how are they? Yeah, there's still a lot of relationships that would require covering for, but it doesn't mean it's impossible.
Yeah.
Gideon is struggling a lot with how much this task puts her back in the place that she was before she got to do swords.
Yeah. There's a lot of reflecting on the past years and the increasing amount of restriction that she observed while trying to, be more than just an indentured servant of the ninth. Circling back to the episode title, Act Accordingly, this is where we see this start to come into this repetition. The very first instance of Act Accordingly is very broad. This is the House of the Ninth, Griddle. We act accordingly. And that is in direct reference to not communicating and not providing information, and implies that that is a core element of what the Ninth does, which
Yeah.
is true.
Yeah, it comes back to silence being such a core theme and secrecy being such a core theme for the identity of the house, in addition to Harrow's personality.
Yeah. It's something that Gideon is like immediately has to unpack, and that unpacking goes back decades.
Yeah, so what stranger was she trying to talk to as a kid where she got bodily dragged away? Like, we're really seeing some clues about not just how shut down the house is, but what it was like for Gideon for the house to become progressively more shut down.
Yeah, over the course of some very vulnerable and experimental years as a child, where you're like, ooh, someone I haven't seen before, like, children that grew up fairly isolated, the novelty of strangers is very stimulating. And then we get, I think, one of the first very charged physical interactions between them
The
in a way
biting.
that the biting and then the chin grab. Oh, it chin grab then bite. It sounds like Gideon is a biter as a person. It was a very swift, reflexive reaction to having her face be grabbed and manipulated and
I love the description of there was a simple joy in watching Harrow swear furiously and shake her hand and peel off the bitten glove, like in seeing sunlight or eating a good meal. Pleasures that are rare for someone who is indentured and living on Pluto, question mark.
And like maybe even only conceptual. Like, when does Gideon get a chance to see sunlight?
Yeah. I mean,
When
some
does
sunlight
Gideon,
reaches.
like, some sunlight reaches, sure. One tiny sunbeam. It's interesting going back through my highlights from previous read-throughs, because that sentence is one of my highlights. And I'm like, I wonder what I was thinking. It's a great sentence. Oh, another makeup piece of information here. A s fat stick of black char. It means that this makeup uses two different types of pigment.
Yeah, that's I hadn't noticed that because the white paint comes in a pot and the black paint comes in a stick. And so the white paint is described as globby and acidy, and the black, it seems like, is maybe derived from, I mean, char could be literal. This could be a charcoal pigment.
Yeah. So thinking of the way those materials blend, and how one would have to do that makeup. 'Cause like if it's charcoal, it doesn't have a binding. So I would imagine it has to have some kind of binder and some kind of adhering quality, which just a stick of charcoal by itself would not. A stick of charcoal by itself would not, but like I think of greasy again, like
This section on the face paints and the robes and the hair cutting kind of gives us some clues about what monastic life is like in the ninth. And also shows us that despite the fact that Harrow has said everything has to be completely correct and completely up to par, she's like, I'm not going to make you cut your hair.
but it's not for Gideon's benefit that she's kind of like, I have to choose where my compromises are. I have to pick my battles here. And maintaining your bodily hygiene is not one of them. Maintaining your bodily appearance is not one of them.
I honestly think that this is secretly a gesture for Gideon's agency. I don't think that she actually gives a shit about that because she's perfectly willing to dominate Gideon all over the place. Like, if she actually thought that it needed to happen, it just wouldn't be negotiable. She'd be like, you're cutting your hair now and you're going to shave your head every day. Period. End of, just end of. And so, why isn't she doing that?
I think it's that she realizes that she has to make concessions. She's not going to get everything she wants going into setting this up. But her concessions can throw Gideon a bone. And she can make ones that are going to make their relationship easier by saying, fine, whatever.
It's
Like,
interesting that it's something she volunteers rather than something that she concedes. Gideon argues about the face paint, and Harrow says, you can have the hair.
Gideon does not immediately accept that, though. Gideon finds it very suspect.
Yeah, she doesn't say, oh, good, thank you. She moves completely away from it. She's like, I want information. I did not ask you for hair. I want information.
Yeah, she says this, you think this is a gesture? This is irrelevant. What I actually need is to know what the fuck we're doing
Yeah.
and the ability to do what it is you're expecting me to do, which is to be good at swords.
So she's In sort of the flow of this conversation at the end of the chapter, Gideon is accepting that she's going to do the face paint. She has dropped objections to the face paint, and Harrow says, "Okay, you have to do the face paint. I'm not making you do the hair." And Gideon's like, "I want my sword and I want information." Like she's like, "Fine, we're done with the face paint. Fuck the hair. I want my sword and I want information." And Harrow's like, "You're absolutely not getting either of those things. So anyway, see you tomorrow."
Gideon talks about what clothes she will be expected to wear and practically advocates for her preferences. She's like, I can't cavalier in a nun robe. Why?
I think we see robes could mean lots of different things. We see that robes have evolved over the centuries in different houses, and what it comes to be a house robe is variable. I don't necessarily think that this means a habit, but it tells us for sure that Gideon is not necessarily wearing house livery on a day-to-day basis, whereas a cavalier primary is expected to wear house livery. And so there is going to be that robe of some kind.
Yeah, and there would be no reason why she would ever wear cavalier livery up to this point.
No.
Interesting enough, we get here that this paint is a core part of many of that. I will track down this fan art, but I saw some fan art of different styles of death face, of skull paint for different types of rituals, different types of roles, different classes.
Yeah, and we learn as we go that there are different acceptable styles of paint, that there's different motifs and approaches that are acceptable.
She specifically refers to the sages of the ninth in terms of what this makes her think of. She doesn't mention the aunties, she doesn't mention Harrow. She mentions these sages. So, assuming that Harrow knows exactly what she's doing in terms of giving direction around this paint and executing it herself, interesting choice, because I imagine there is cavalier specific paint.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because we learn later that Ordis did the jawless skull because it complemented the shape of his head well. So it does seem like it's to some degree aesthetic.
And a personal expression.
I kind of think about it like picking, your favorite saint. Like all the
Within the
saints are
books?
valid. No.
Within the books, within Catholicism.
Within Catholicism,
Got
like
it, got it,
people
got it.
have relationships with different saints and will display icons of different saints. And ultimately, there's not like a wrong saint. They're all great and holy and like it's all good. But like people have
Well,
preferences.
counterpoint. Counterpoint, recently was looking at a photograph of one of the most recent canonized saints, Mother Teresa.
There are wrong
There's
answers. Okay, that's fair.
there are bad saints, I will say.
From the perspective of the Vatican, they're all great.
Sure. And the Vatican's perspective is perfect, flawless, no notes. Ooh. Ooh. It's interesting. Mother Teresa was someone my mother quite liked growing up, and there was like a quote or something, a picture of her on the fridge. And so watching that heinous old hag get canonized was really fascinating. But if you look at like saints are people who have done ex have had extraordinary impact. And yeah, you pick someone based on that particular unique impact. And as a child, I was directed towards Saint Francis of Assisi because I loved animals and he loves animals. So there's definitely like, yeah, pick a favorite saint and, like throw their name into the mix, into your own name. And the Catholic naming tradition involves adopting saint names into your own. And you kind of go do a bit of history and being like, oh, what the but there are cool saints. There are saints that are like, oh, you fuck shit up. Cool. Cool. And you fuck shit up in like ways that really disrupted the order within your immediate environment?
I love the different ways that Gideon and Harrow talk about these pinup magazines over the course of the first several chapters. Because we get a lot of clues about these magazines, and Harrow privately in this conversation with Gideon just calls them pinup mags or pinup rags, which is dismissive, but it's not pearl clutchy. Whereas in the Shuttlefield encounter, when Harrow is responding to Crux saying that Gideon showed him sick pornographies, she makes this reference to, like, maybe the cohort will have you arrested because of all the horrific, sick magazines. Like, she's making such a big deal about it. And then privately, she's like, yeah, you like to look at girls, whatever.
Yeah. I am wondering how Gideon got access to these, when, how long has she been collecting?
How many does she have?
How many does she have, and how do they get to the ninth?
And how old are they?
Because I could see that being a, like, back when pilgrims were still a thing, there would be probably more movement of different types of publications. There would be more various amenities and things that could be acquired on the ninth for people who are visiting, which may include pornographies.
The fact that they're described as pinups specifically and the strong orientation to military hero stories makes me think a lot about the government-created pinup magazines that were distributed among at least the Allies, I don't know beyond that, in World War II. So I'm wondering if the source of these magazines were the embedded cohort members of the ninth who used to be part of the cohort, which it hasn't happened for, I think, like 10 years, but they might have, like, Gideon could have encountered these magazines among ex-cohort belongings. So these could be the pinup magazines that were circulating 10 and 20 years ago, or even longer ago, among soldiers in the cohort that came back with them to the ninth after their tours of service, that Gideon encountered, like, on a salvage mish with, like, or doing just like normal, cleanup stuff, like, okay, this guy died, we need to, like, clear his cell out.
Yeah, and it, if she is, as she claims, reading the articles, it would explain a lot of her perspectives about military heroism and the different lived experiences of people within the Empire. It would absolutely explain her perspective that the prisons are hospitable, humane places. If this is her main source of learning about the outside world, it being a government publication, it actively being propaganda makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so she's hearing about heroes versus terrorists, and she's hearing about.
Sexy Cavalier Calendar?
Yeah, it's interesting. Gideon is imagining. Gideon is really into these pinup rags, and she's not imagining sexy necros. She's imagining sexy calves.
And like, I'm imagining an advertisement in the back of one of these magazines for a calendar like this.
I'm thinking of Israeli and increasingly US propaganda featuring, like, Instagram models, the idea of soldiers as super hot and you should join because you're gonna get to meet these super hot soldiers being, like, a very new approach in the last couple decades.
Yeah. And specifically in Israeli propaganda, too, they use LGBTQ coding in a fair amount of it as well. So there's like the idea that it's like, be a hot gay in the Israeli military. Like, this thing where it's like, oh, you think you're an outsider, you're actually an insider. You're one of us. You can be one of us. You're already hot. You like, it's this invitation to be a part of something where you're like, you're marginalized in your day-to-day experience. Well, here in the military, you're celebrated for your differences.
And it's interesting that being hot is so important to Gideon, given that she's not in a universe that has TV movies. She's not in a universe where she has a dating pool. She doesn't have a lot of peers to compare herself. And so, where is she getting this pressure to be hot and this sense that being hot is really important to her? At like her value. And it seems like that is coming from these government propaganda magazines. And that's weird.
Yeah, that's weird.
I love the exchange at the end where, yeah, Gideon is pressing for more options and more agency and more information. And Harrow says, "Paint your face, train with the rapier, you're dismissed." And Gideon says, "Isn't this the part where you give me intel?" And Harrow says, "God, no."
Moira Quirk's voicing of this dialogue to me is really strikingly different in terms of that casualness compared to previous Harrow monologues and Harrow expressions. It's very like, I mean, it's sincere. This isn't a performance. This is just like, what? You think I'm gonna tell you shit? What? No. Why? But here we have another one of those fantastic allusions to future parts of the book, which is, I'll mix bone meal in with your breakfast and punch my way through your gut. And I'm like, hey, soup.
Which Gideon admits was entirely plausible.
Ideas Harrow already had and was just waiting to do. You know, slight difference. You used a bit of marrow instead of bone meal because you ha use what you have on hand when you're cooking. Now I'm just watching for those like a hawk. Punch my way through your gut, 5,000 nails.
Yeah.
Little cookies left
There
along
was
the
the
way.
tell him my shuttle blew up.
Yep. I bet there's like one more hiding in here that we haven't
Oh,
highlighted.
there's, yeah, there's so
This.
many. She loves doing these.
And like, it is a gift to us as rereaders.
Absolutely. I think this book is really designed to be reread and to be reread in depth. This was a very short chapter. This chapter is only 5 pages long. And as we move forward, Gideon moves into preparing to take on the role of Cavalier Primary, which she has finally well and fully accepted, fighting it all. Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaley and edited by Han Kaley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is by Han Kaley. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.